Abe came to the funeral, along with his whole family. But that alone didn't stand out to me, as literally hundreds turned out for the service, and the whole thing was a blur anyway. It was the handwritten note he sent me later that really registered. He didn't say anything that profound, just how sorry he was, and that he had always looked up to my brother, in pretty much all respects. A lot of people did. Daniel was that kind of all-around great guy, but the fact that Gabe actually took the time to spell out his admiration meant a lot. So when I saw him a few weeks later at East West Bistro in Athens, I went up to him and thanked him. He nodded, and I braced myself for that awkward line of questioning about how I was doing. But he didn't go there, just said again how sorry he was, then changed the subject, for which I was as grateful as for any note of sympathy. We talked the rest of that night, and after last call, he walked me back to my apartment and nonchalantly asked for my number. I told him I had a boyfriend, which was a stretch. I was just hooking up with some baseball player, but wanted to be clear that I didn't like him like that. Gabe shrugged and said that was fine. He just wanted to hang out as friends.
I've always thought you were cool.
Because I believed him, and because I was nothing if not cool, I gave him my number, and we became instantly tight. Mostly, we'd sit in bars and drink, or sit in one of our apartments and drink. But we also walked his dog, an ancient black lab named Woody, and studied for the anthropology class that neither of us realized the other was in because we both blew it off so often, and went to see bands and smoked an occasional bag of weed. Our friendship felt unusual because it was. Not so much because of the guy-girl thing, but because we really didn't have all that much in common, even back when everyone in college had a lot in common. Gabe was outside the mainstream, and a little bit of a hipster. Nothing like my girlfriends or the guys I normally gravitated toward. I found him refreshing, though he had a tendency to playfully put me down. I quickly lost count of the number of times he looked at me, incredulous, and said,
"How do you not know that?"
Or, "You really need to read that, see that, listen to that." But I could tell he appreciated my straightforward simplicity, just as I liked his layers, and somehow we just clicked. Over the years, Meredith and my other friends questioned our platonic deal, accusing us of covertly hooking up. At the very least, they thought Gabe had a thing for me, or I had a thing for him. I was always adamant that we did not. Yes, there would probably always be very fleeting moments of attraction between close friends of different genders, especially when drinking was involved. But with Gabe and me, it was never enough to trigger a lapse of judgment, or worse, an ill-fated attempt at an actual relationship. And it became an unspoken given that neither of us wanted to risk our cherished friendship in the name of lust, loneliness, or idle curiosity. In other words, we were living proof that guys and girls could, in fact, be just friends. It also helped, of course, that Gabe wasn't my type, nor was I his. I was curvy and blonde and girl next door cute, and Gabe liked petite, rail-thin brunettes. The more exotic, the better. His last two girlfriends had been Asian, and from the neck down, they both looked like teenaged boys. Meanwhile, I preferred broad-shouldered, clean-cut, blue-eyed jocks, a far cry from Gabe's lanky build, dark eyes, and omnipresent 5 o'clock shadow, which often veered toward an actual beard, which I downright disliked.
"Don't get me wrong,"
Gabe says now, signaling the bartender for another beer. I can tell by his expression that he's still on the subject of Will. Sure enough, he finishes by saying,
"I'm glad you guys broke up."
"Gee, thanks," I say. "You're happy I'm 37 and single and desperate?" He grins and says,
"Kinda."
I smile, because I know what he means, and feel the same. I'm always a little happier when Gabe is single, and felt total relief when he broke up with his most recent girlfriend, an insufferably snobbish, name-dropping gallery girl. It isn't that we don't wish the best for each other, because we truly do. I want Gabe to fall in love and get married and have a family, even though he isn't sure he's cut out for that. And I know he wants the same for me. But it is hard to deny an element of classic misery loves company, not an uncommon dynamic among close single friends. As an aside, and a backstop, We have always vowed that we will never date someone who isn't cool with our grandfathered-in friendship. In fact, Gabe once called it a screening device, a way to weed out unstable, jealous girls, whom he also calls the psycho set. Interestingly, the only person who ever really had a problem with Gabe was Will, who called him the depressed poser. It was an unfair charge, as Gabe never tries to impress anyone, and really cares little what others think of him, almost to a fault. He isn't exactly depressed either, just a little moody and caustic, which can sometimes wear on people. But he can also be really funny, with a generosity and sense of loyalty that offset his edges. There's no doubt in my mind that Gabe would do anything for me.
So what's up with Meredith?
He says, changing the subject. I sigh and tell him the latest, that she and my mother have some big plan they're working up for this December. You know, it's been 15 years. An intent listener, he looks at me waiting. They want to visit Sophie in New York, I continue.
Sophie?
Gabe asks. You know, the girl he was dating.
Oh, right.
Gabe shakes his head and whistles. Exactly, I say. So unhealthy, isn't it?
It's a little strange. I'll give you that.
I can tell he is treading carefully, the way he always does around any mention of Daniel. It's very strange, bizarre. They all need to move on with their lives already. He raises his eyebrows and looks at me, and I can tell that he is thinking about Will again. I can almost read the bubble over his head.
Isn't that the pot calling the kettle black?
What? I say, feeling defensive.
Nothing,
he says with such purposeful, wide-eyed innocence that I'm forced to take drastic measures. I pick up my phone and bang out an email, both my thumbs flying. From Josie, sent August 18th, to Andrea Carlisle. Subject, re-room mom. Dear Andrea, thank you so much for your kind note. Edie is a pleasure, and I can't wait to get to know her better this year. I hope the Tooth Fairy is good to her tonight. Thank you for volunteering to be our room mother. I would love to accept your kind offer. Look forward to meeting you at Open House. And yes, it is a small world. Best, Josie. I scan it quickly for errors, then send it, listening to the sickening swooshing sound of an irreversible decision. Fair, I say, showing him the sent message. He quickly skims it, then hands me back my phone and smirks.
Whoa, look at you, little miss well-adjusted.
I am well-adjusted, I say, and for one second, I actually believe it. That night, I wake up around 2 and can't fall back asleep. I tell myself that it's just first week of school jitters, or adjusting to an earlier bedtime. But as morning approaches, I know it runs deeper than that. I know it has something to do with Daniel and Sophie, Mom and Meredith, Will and Andrea. And maybe most of all, it has something to do with Edie, fast asleep at this very moment. I imagine her blonde curls spilling over her pillow, the shiny coin underneath it, as she dreams her magical dreams. I think of my conversation with Gabe, the person who knows me best, and the only one who knows my secret. My heart aches with regret over so many things, big and small, including mistakes that have relegated me to manufacturing boyfriends on faraway continents who are as imaginary as the Tooth Fairy herself.
Chapter 4. Meredith. On Friday night, 45 minutes before Nolan and I are leaving for dinner with friends, our babysitter cancels via text. So sorry, I'm sick and can't watch Harper tonight. I have food poisoning. Sad face, sad face, sad face. Liar, I say, before slamming my phone onto the bathroom counter. Hard enough so that I check to make sure I haven't cracked the screen. Even if I believed she were sick, which I do not, her flippant, so sorry, along with those three emojis, would still have pushed me over the edge. Who you calling a liar? Nolan calls out from our closet, where he is getting dressed. The sitter, I answer. She just canceled. Who is she? Nolan asks, emerging in boxers, socks, and a new light blue linen shirt. One of the many luxuries of being the husband, at least in our household, is that Nolan does not concern himself with domestic logistics like hiring sitters. All he has to do is pick out his own shirt. The middle Troper girl, I say. I bet she's canceling because of a boy. She could have food poisoning, Nolan says. People do get food poisoning, you know. No way. Who gets food poisoning at 6:45 on a Friday night? And by the way, if you truly do have food poisoning, then lie and say it's anything other than food poisoning, because food poisoning always sounds like a lie when you're canceling. It really does, Nolan says with a laugh. Why is that anyway? Because it usually is. I should call her out on it. Tell her to go ahead and come anyway, since it's not contagious. You can't babysit with food poisoning, Nolan says, missing the point. I watch him unbutton his shirt, then put it back on one of the padded hangers from my end of the closet. What are you doing? Put that back on, I say. I'll see if my mother or Josie can come watch Harper. Really? He says, looking disappointed. Don't you want to go out? I say, thinking that I've been looking forward to our plans with the Grahams all week. I guess, he says. But I'm just as happy to stay in. We could order Chinese and watch Homeland. We have 3 episodes left. I cross my arms and glare at him. We hardly ever go out, I say. That's not true, he says. We just went out to dinner last Saturday. Yes, but that was with work people. That doesn't count, I say, knowing that if we stay in, Nolan will watch TV while I put Harper to bed, an arduous, frustrating task that can take hours. I stop short of telling him that I'm desperate to have a few drinks and a grown-up evening without our daughter, in no particular order, and instead say again that I'm going to try my mother and Josie. Maybe one of them is free. You know Josie's going to be busy. When has she ever not had plans on a Friday night? Nolan says in shirtless limbo. Always in good shape, he's even more fit than usual, gearing up for his next triathlon, his morning training conveniently conflicting with getting Harper ready for school and out the door. I text them both just in case, but just as Nolan predicted, Josie types back immediately that she is otherwise engaged. My mom writes that she would love to, but already has plans to go to the movies with Kay, her friend from church. Damn it, I grumble to myself. We could call the Grahams and ask them to come hang out here instead, Nolan says. I shake my head, feeling annoyed by the suggestion. The house is a mess, and we have nothing to eat here. So what? He says. We can order a pizza. I don't want to do that, I say, thinking that I will still be the one stuck putting Harper to bed. Besides, the Grahams don't want to pay for a sitter for their children only so they can spend the evening with ours. All right, he says. Well, I'm sure we can think of something else fun to do. He gives me his little double-finger gun and a wink, and although I know he's trying to be funny, it's also a serious suggestion on his part. I give him a little non-committal grunt, wondering where I'd rank sex with my husband these days, before or after putting our daughter to bed. I know how I sound. I sound like a shitty mother and wife. Or at the very least, an inadequate wife and ungrateful mother, which is in stark contrast to the image I try to portray on Instagram. Hashtag happy life, hashtag beautiful family, hashtag blessed. Sometimes, like tonight, I find myself wondering which is more egregious, to pretend to be happy when you're not, or to feel so consistently dissatisfied when you should be happy. My therapist, Amy, tells me not to be so hard on myself, which probably has a lot to do with why I keep going back to her. She says that everyone creates a version of her life that she wishes were true and tries to believe. In other words, everyone lies on social media, or at least puts her best foot and photos forward. Amy also points out that although I have a lot to be thankful for, I did lose my brother in a tragic accident that rocked my family to the core, either directly or indirectly caused my parents to divorce, and left me with a sole sibling who is some combination of selfish and self-destructive. In other words, I'm entitled to my frustration and deep-seated sadness, regardless of how many positive things have happened to me since that horrific day. As an aside, I also appreciate Amy's 40-something perspective that the 30s are a grind for many, and motherhood isn't the constantly blissful journey everyone thinks it will be when they attend their pink or blue or yellow baby shower. She swears that things get easier as your kids get older and become more self-sufficient. But she also maintains that no matter what their age or yours, motherhood is hard. Really hard. Stay-at-home mothers have it rough. Working mothers have it rough. And part-time working mothers like myself have it rough. Even though the first two camps annoyingly insist that we have the best of both worlds, when I think we actually have the worst of each. There. I just did it again. Bitch, bitch, bitch. And I mean that as a noun and a verb. To be clear, I love my daughter more than anything or anyone in the world. She is the best thing I have ever done or will ever do with my life. It's just that taking care of a small child often feels tedious to me. A fact I can only admit to Amy, the person I pay to give me 1-hour increments of complete honesty. I can't tell my husband, who labeled me unmaternal in a recent argument. I can't tell my friends, because it would undermine my perfect Facebook facade. I can't tell my sister, who desperately wants a child of her own. And I can't tell my mother, because I know she'd do anything to get back a few moments with her firstborn. Even the kind of miserable, exhausting moments that I routinely gripe about. Besides, my mother needs me to be okay. The child she doesn't have to worry about. The only one who hasn't fucked up or died. The more pressing issue, an even more closely guarded secret, is the way I feel about Nolan, my husband of nearly 7 years. I'm not sure where to begin, other than at the beginning, with the answer to that question. So how did you two meet? Every couple has their canned answer. Their story that's told again and again. Sometimes the husband will take the lead in the retelling. Sometimes the wife will. Sometimes it's a tandem effort, scripted down to the smallest one-liner, suspenseful beat, wistful glance, fond chuckle, serendipitous plot twist. And then he said this, and then I did that, and now here we are, happily ever after. Sometimes I wonder if part of my problem with Nolan isn't our story itself, the how and why we got together. Because even if I stick to the abridged, upbeat dinner party version and avoid maudlin details such as, Nolan was the pallbearer at my brother's funeral, we always return to Daniel. Growing up, and for as long as I can remember, Nolan was my brother's best friend. Although with a 4.5-year age gap, I actually didn't pay much attention to either of them, at least when I was really little. He was just a fixture, like the tweed sectional in our family room, or my father's workbench in the garage. Part of the backdrop of my childhood. One of the many older boys who came to trade baseball cards or throw a football in the backyard, or spend the night, sleeping in the trundle pulled out from under Daniel's twin bed. By the time I reached middle school, it was harder to ignore Daniel and his friends, if only because Josie was paying such close attention to them. I remember her carrying on about Nolan in particular, and had to agree that he was easy on the eyes. With wavy blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and the kind of skin that easily tanned, he had such obvious Malibu lifeguard good looks that Daniel teasingly called him Baywatch. He also happened to be Daniel's most athletic friend, a natural at every sport he played, though he didn't have Daniel's drive or work ethic, which evened things out for them on the playing fields. But what stood out to me the most was Nolan's sense of humor, the laid-back way he approached everything, in stark contrast to my type A brother. In many ways, they really were opposites, their differences becoming more pronounced over the years. As Daniel graduated as Lovett's valedictorian, then headed north for Harvard, while Nolan focused on girls and parties at Ole Miss, barely eking out a 2.0 GPA, all he needed to return to Atlanta to work at his family's printing business. Yet despite their divergent paths, the two stayed close, always picking up right where they left off. In fact, just a few days before Daniel died, I overheard him telling Sophie that Nolan would one day be his best man. So it was both fitting and gut-wrenching when we returned home from the hospital the morning after the accident, to find Nolan leaning against his black Tahoe, parked haphazardly in our driveway, his front door open. As my parents and I got out of our car and neared him, he must have been able to tell that something was wrong, very wrong. Yet he calmly asked, "Where have y'all been? Where's Danny? We were supposed to shoot hoops at 10. He was eating a glazed donut and licked his thumb, waiting for a reply. I held my breath and looked at my father, still wearing the crumpled suit from his business trip, his red tie stuffed into his pocket. He started to answer, but then put his head down and hurried into the house, my mother clutching his arm. Nolan stepped out of his truck, his smile fading. "Meredith?" he said with a questioning look. "What's going on?" I was only 20, not even old enough for a legal drink, yet it was clear that I would be the one to tell Daniel's best friend that he was gone. "Daniel was in a car accident last night," I said, somehow finding my voice, though my throat was constricting, my heart pounding in my ears. "Is he okay?" Nolan nodded, as if cueing me for the right answer. "He's going to be okay. Right, Meredith?" He nodded again, his eyes wide. I took a deep breath, then made myself say it aloud for the first time. "Daniel died." Nolan stared back at me, his face blank, as if he hadn't heard what I said or simply couldn't process the meaning of my words. "A truck hit his car at the corner of Moore's Mill and Northside," I numbly reported, still in shock. "He was wearing his seatbelt, but his internal injuries were too great. They said it happened fast. He didn't suffer at all." I repeated the words exactly as I'd heard my mother tell my grandparents. "He didn't suffer at all." I wanted so desperately to believe it was true, but would always doubt it. Always wonder about Daniel's final thought, and whether he knew what was happening to him. Nolan collapsed sideways onto his front seat, his long legs hanging out the door, his untied high tops planted in the driveway. I held my breath in horror as he let out a string of obscenities, his voice a low, guttural moan. "My God, no. Jesus fucking Christ. Oh, fuck. Christ, no." My instinct was to flee, escape the sound and sight of Nolan. But I couldn't leave him. So I finally walked around the front of his car, opened the passenger door, and climbed in beside him. Only then did I register how cold I was, and that I had left my coat at the hospital. "Can you turn on the heat?" I asked quietly. Nolan shifted in his seat, pulled his door shut, and turned the key still dangling in the ignition. The radio came blaring on before he silenced it with his fist, then followed that up with a hard punch to his dash, splitting open his knuckle. I reached into my purse and handed him a tissue, but he didn't take it. Blood trickled down his hand and wrist as he announced that he was going to take off. "You're leaving?" I said, suddenly panicking, dreading going into my house, literally afraid of seeing Josie, knowing that we no longer had a brother, that it was just the two of us. "I think I should," he said. "Right?" I shook my head, staring at the bag of donuts on the seat between us. "No. Please come in."
"Are you sure? Shouldn't it just be
family?"
Nolan's voice cracked as tears began to stream down his face.
"You are family," I said. "Daniel would want you to come in." Almost everyone describes the immediate aftermath of death the same way, as a surreal blur, at least for those in the inner circle in charge of the details. I watched people come and go, close friends, neighbors, and relatives, including some I barely knew. They dropped off food, offered condolences, cried. Mom and Dad picked out a coffin and a cemetery plot with the lady from the funeral home, and planned Daniel's service with John Simmons, our longtime pastor. Dad sat in his office and wrote the eulogy, a glass of whiskey on his desk. Meanwhile, I can't remember Nolan ever leaving, though he must have gone home to sleep and shower. At my parents' request, he sat in the living room with Daniel's computer, going through all of his contacts, emailing and calling his college and medical school friends one by one. He even phoned Sophie within hours of her plane landing, and I listened to his conversation, marveling at how he said all the right things, how much Daniel loved her, how special she was to him. He pored through our family's photo albums, putting together a collage that would be displayed at the wake. And when there was nothing left to do, he simply sat with me in stunned silence, the forever of it all just starting to sink in. It was hard to call him a comfort exactly, because nothing could console any of us at that point. But there was something about his presence that was reassuring. He was nothing like my brother, but he was still a strong and powerful connection to him, and I could see so clearly why Daniel had loved him. About a week after the funeral, the day before I returned to Syracuse to finish my junior year of college, Nolan stopped by to say hello and, in his words, check in on everyone. Standing in our foyer, he glanced up the staircase as I told him my mom was already in bed with a migraine and my dad was at the office, working late. "And Josie?" he asked. "Is she back at school?" "Not yet. She leaves next week." "I don't know where she is tonight," I said, thinking it was par for the course, before the accident and especially since. I wasn't sure where she'd been going or who she'd been hanging out with, but I had barely seen her for days. We had yet to talk about that night, where she had been or how she'd found out, and I was starting to get the feeling we never would. That Daniel's death was going to push us further apart than we already were. Nolan shoved his hands in his pockets, looked at me for a few seconds, then asked if I wanted to get a bite to eat. Feeling both surprised and strangely flattered by the invitation, I said yes. For the next hour, we drove around Buckhead, trying to decide where to go, vetoing restaurant after restaurant, before we finally settled on the OK Cafe, a brightly lit Southern comfort food diner. Choosing a booth in the back, we ate barbecue and macaroni and cheese, drank sweet tea, and talked about everything but Daniel. Instead, Nolan asked me questions, basic ones, as if he hadn't known me my whole life, which in some ways, I guess he hadn't. "Why'd you pick Syracuse?" he asked. "I've never known a single person from Atlanta to go to Syracuse, except you." "Isn't that a good enough reason?" I deadpanned. "Seriously?" he said with a smile, both dimples firing. "Yeah, actually, kind of," I said, smiling a little myself. "Plus, they have a really good drama school." "Oh, that's right," he said. "You're a theater girl. You were in a lot of plays at Pace, weren't you?" I nodded and said that was my thing. One of the reasons I had chosen to go to a different high school from my brother and sister. "Daniel was proud of you." I stared at my plate, trying not to cry, as Nolan distracted me with more rapid-fire questions. "So, you want to be an actress?" I nodded again. "But you're so shy," he said. Something people often said to me when I told them what I was studying. "I'm not really shy. I'm an introvert." I went on to explain the difference. The fact that being around people didn't make me uneasy. I just preferred to be alone most of the time. "Daniel was an introvert, too. He was selective about who he spent time with. He loved hanging out with you." Nolan smiled, as it occurred to me that maybe he wasn't just being nice by inviting me to dinner. Maybe I was a comfort to him, too, his closest connection to Daniel. "How else are you like?" he asked. I hesitated, unsure of what tense to use, the present for me or the past for him. "I have his OCD and his GPA," I smiled. Though you can't really compare neurosurgery and Shakespearean theater. I'm smart, but he was way smarter. What you study has nothing to do with your IQ. True, I said. Though I was still sure Daniel's had been higher than mine. Higher than anyone's in our family. You two are more alike than you and Josie, aren't you? He asked. I nodded. Yeah, she's a straight extrovert party girl. But it's weird. I'm more like Daniel, but he was closer to her. I felt a stab of jealousy, then guilt for feeling jealous. Daniel was drawn to people like you and her. Fuck ups, he smiled. Happy people, I said, wrapping my hands around my warm mug, having switched to coffee. Fun people. You could always make him laugh. Nolan's lower lip quivered. I heard him tell Sophie that you were going to be his best man one day.
He said that?
Yeah, I said. But you already knew that, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess I did, he said.
But he was the best man. The best friend you could have. God, all the times he had my back, the messes he got me out of. I mustered a smile, recalling some of the funny stories in Nolan's eulogy. How he had so perfectly captured Daniel's loyal, solid essence, while painting himself as the foolhardy sidekick. I still can't believe it was him, and not me, Nolan said. God, I wish it had been me. I shook my head, although I'd had the same wish about myself. If only it had been me, I'd thought more than once. Then my parents would still have a daughter to spare. Later that night, when Nolan dropped me back at the house, he asked if he could see Daniel's room. I hesitated, feeling uneasy. I had yet to set foot in his room, and knew that my parents had only been in there once, and that was only out of necessity to get Daniel's burial clothes. But I said yes, and the two of us walked silently into the house, then upstairs and down the hall to my brother's closed bedroom door. My heart raced as I turned the knob and peered inside. The room was dark, the shades drawn, and for a second, I actually found myself praying that we would find a miracle. Daniel asleep in his bed. The whole thing a bad dream. But the sight of his creaseless comforter and tight hospital corners confirmed our nightmare. Jesus, Nolan whispered, as we took a few tentative steps into the room, our eyes adjusting to the dark. I tried to speak, but couldn't begin to think of what to say. There was nothing to say. But Nolan found something. I don't think I've been up here since high school. It looks exactly the same. I nodded, grateful that my parents hadn't redecorated our rooms the way a lot of parents did when their kids left for school, and wondered if they ever would now. Nolan and I looked around, taking visual inventory of Daniel's bookshelf lined with paperback novels and tennis trophies and signed baseballs and his snow globe collection. We studied the framed baseball jerseys hanging on his walls, and the collage of photos tacked to the bulletin board, and the stack of medical books on his desk. His suitcase was open and neatly arranged on an ottoman in the corner, and I could see the pajamas Josie had given him for Christmas, the tag still on them. I stared at the jar of Carmex on his nightstand, sitting on top of Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point, an index card slipped inside, somewhere around the midway point. I had a sudden urge to read the page he had last read, but didn't dare touch anything. I could tell Nolan felt the same. As if we were standing before a roped-off room in a museum, staring back into history. The end of a young man's life. A moment frozen in time. We looked and looked until there was nothing left to observe. And then Nolan took my hand in his, pulled me to his chest, and wrapped his arms around me. I love you, Meredith, he whispered in my ear. Of course I knew what he meant, and in what way he loved me, a fond, surrogate big brother way. But the words still caught me off guard, along with the goosebumps that rose on my arms as I whispered it back. I love you too, Nolan. In that second, I could no longer deny what I'd been trying to deny for weeks, maybe even years. I had a crush on Nolan. It was absurd on so many fronts. Even the word was flimsy, silly, and stupid amid our monumental loss. Beyond the fact that Nolan was too old and way too good-looking for me, he was my brother's best friend. Off-limits before, and certainly now. Besides, how could I be attracted to anyone so soon after my brother's death? It was the kind of inappropriate thing that would happen to Josie, not me. And yet, there it was. As unmistakable as my clammy hands and racing, guilty heart. I looked away, telling myself that the whole thing was probably in my head, some sort of delusional reaction to grief, post-traumatic stress. It would pass. And even if it didn't, nobody would ever know. I would never tell him. I would never tell anyone. "We better go," I said, backing away from him. "Yeah," he said, running his hand through his hair, looking rattled. "I better head out." A few seconds later, we were back downstairs in the foyer, saying an awkward goodnight. "So you're leaving for school tomorrow?" he asked. "Yeah," I said. "Tomorrow morning." "Okay," Nolan said, giving me a quick hug followed by a peck on the cheek. "Take care of yourself, Mare." "You too, Nolan," I said.
"I'll keep in touch. I promise," he said as sincerely as you can say anything.
I nodded, believing that was his intention, but also doubting it would actually happen. Eventually, we would lose touch, my family's connection to Nolan becoming a secondary casualty of our tragedy. "So, I have a proposal for you," I say to Harper when I find her in her bedroom, my childhood bedroom, after officially canceling our dinner plans and changing into my most comfortable pajamas. She looks up from her collection of stuffed mice, which live in the bottom drawer of her nightstand, and says,
"What is it?"
"Do you know what that means?" I ask, sitting on the edge of her bed. "It's a deal. Do you want to make a deal?" She gives me a suspicious look, but nods, willing to at least hear me out. "If you brush your teeth and get right to bed, I'll read you 2 bedtime stories, and..." I pause to build suspense. "I won't go out." With a glimmer in her eye, she says,
"No babysitter?"
"No babysitter," I say. She grins at me. Other than my mom, Nolan's parents, and Josie, Harper hates having a sitter, especially at night. And even the fun young ones send her into a tailspin of separation, anxiety, and grief. "But you have to go straight to bed after that, lights out. And you have to stay in bed. No shenanigans." She stares at me, and I can see the wheels turning in her head. "Do we have a deal?" I say, knowing that I'm up against the single best negotiator in Atlanta. Sure enough, she has a counteroffer.
4 books," she says.
I try not to smile as I say, 3.
"No, 5,
she says, holding up one fist, then opening it, flashing her fingers. I shake my head, calmly explaining that it doesn't work that way. Once she says 4, she can't go back up to 5. But because I admire her moxie, I give in a little bit.
"Let's start with 3 and see how that goes. If it's not too late, we'll do a 4th.
"Now go on," I say, gesturing toward her bookcase. "You choose, honey." Jubilant, she skips to her bookcase, strategically selecting 3 of her picture books with the most words per page. The girl is no dummy. Her first 2 selections are solid, but then she reaches for Horton Hears a Who, and I let out a little groan. Although I love the book's strong moral message of tolerance and equality, I'm not in the mood for Dr. Seuss.
"Can I get 1 veto?" I say, thinking there are so many great books we've neglected for a while.
"No, Mommy," she says, putting her hand on her hip. "You said I could choose, and I choose Horton Hears a Who."
"Fair enough," I say. "Now come on, go brush your teeth." She nods, then heads straight for the bathroom that my sister and I used to share,
while I straighten up her toys, tuck in her mice, and settle into her twin bed to wait for her. A few seconds later, she is back. I resist the urge to tell her she couldn't possibly have brushed her teeth thoroughly in that amount of time, and instead just slide over, making room for her. She climbs into bed, smelling of bubblegum toothpaste, and hands me Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. It's one of my favorites, and one I can remember my mother reading to Josie and me when we were kids. I tell Harper this because she loves hearing about Mommy and Josie when we were little. She smiles, her face lit with anticipation as she nestles into the crook of my arm. I open the book and start to read in my most animated voice, savoring the sweetness of the moment, reminding myself to never take anything for granted.
Chapter 5, Josie. On Friday night, just as I'm about to head out the door on a Match.com date with a physical therapist named Pete, Meredith texts with a last-minute plea to babysit and a rant about a lying teenager. I hesitate before I write her back, actually considering the request because, frankly, I'd rather spend the evening with Harper than make small talk with a random guy, even if his profile picture is pretty cute. But I decide to soldier through with my plans because you just never know when you could be canceling on your future husband. I do, however, decide that this will be it. My final, last-ditch Hail Mary date. If things don't pan out with Pete the PT, I'm officially done. Admitting defeat. Throwing in the towel on a traditional family and life. I'm not sure what that means exactly. Whether I'll up and move to Africa to do my own goodwill work, like my faux beau Jack. Or whether I'll go to sperm bank, single mother route. But I won't continue on this futile path. I've made such claims before, but this time is different. This time I really mean it. I repeat all of this to myself as I drive up Peachtree on the way to meet Pete, realizing that I feel no pressure whatsoever. In fact, part of me actually wants the date to outright suck, because a bad date is better than a date rating in that murky 6 out of 10 gray area. Just enough to get your hopes up. Hopes that are inevitably dashed by the second or third date when you discover that he's actually a 4 or 5. Or worse yet, you determine by your second or third date that he's really an 8 or 9 or 10, which is pretty much a guarantee that he'll never call you again. So, instead of giving myself my usual pre-date pep talk, I focus on my preliminary petty criticisms of Pete, the PT. For starters, there's his overuse of emojis, our thread littered with cartoonish outbursts, including the decidedly dorky thumbs up, followed by a glass of red wine after confirming the details of our date. Then there is the matter of his Facebook profile picture, a close-up of a black cat, which I only know because he broke one of the cardinal rules of blind dating by friending me on Facebook before our date. And finally, his choice of restaurants tonight is Brio, a generic Italian chain. Not a bad place for a meal per se, but definitely lame for a first date. Incidentally, the old desperate to get married me would be searching for excuses for Pete, such as 1. Emojis signal lightheartedness. 2. Highly evolved men who don't need to be fawned over every second by a dog tend to like cats. And 3. Brio is next door to Barnes & Noble, and he also suggested that we peruse the store after dinner, a further sign of his enlightenment. But that was the old me. The new me says, "Here goes nothing," as I pull up to the valet, then walk into the restaurant. I immediately spot Pete sitting at the bar wearing the red polo shirt he texted me he'd be wearing, followed by a winking emoji. He's looking down at his phone, which gives me a few seconds to scrutinize him and form a first impression. He isn't a heartthrob by any stretch, but he is at least as cute as his photo. Unfortunately, a solid 7. I can't tell how tall he is, but he has an athletic build and a strong enough chin to offset his slightly receding hairline, as I remind myself that his chin doesn't change the fact that he picked Brio. We make eye contact, and he waves. I approach him with a smile and nothing to lose. "Josie?" he says, standing when I arrive at the bar, confirming a height of about 5'9", maybe 5'10". He has a nice, deep enough voice with no detectable accent, though I know from his Match profile that he is from Wisconsin. I like his teeth, and I really like his smile, which raises him a half a point. "Hi, Pete," I say. He asks if I'd like to stay at the bar or get a table. I start to say I don't care, but then choose the bar. If the conversation becomes painful, we can always include the bartender, a little trick I've learned along the way. "So, it's really nice to meet you," Pete says as we sit on our stools and angle our bodies toward each other. I hang my purse on a hook under the bar and am careful not to make knee contact. "Nice to meet you, too," I say, noticing the cleft in his chin, a plus, which I remind myself is really a minus. "Glad this finally worked out," Pete says, referring to our scheduling difficulty over the past few weeks. "Me too," I say, and on a whim, decide to share my observation that he's in the minority camp of looking better than his profile picture.
"That's funny," Pete says. "I was just thinking the same thing about you."
I smile back at him and say, "Always better to undersell, right?" He laughs and says, "Yes, good point." "But while we're on the subject of photos," I say, "may I offer you some advice on your Facebook profile pic?"
"You mean the Facebook request you denied?"
"I didn't deny it. I just ignored it."
"Fair enough," he says, smiling.
"So what's your advice?" "Lose the cat."
"What?" Pete says with an exaggerated gasp. "You don't like Fudge?"
"His name is Fudge?"
"Her. And yes, her name is Fudge. Because she's black. Get it?"
"Wow," I say, shaking my head, smirking.
"What?"
Pete asks. "Fudge," I say. "That's a really weak name."
"My niece named her Fudge," he says, "and now she's dead."
For a second, I think he means his niece is dead, and I'm beyond horrified by my ultimate foot in the mouth. Then I realize that he probably means the cat is dead. "Fudge died?" I say.
"Yes, my niece was devastated. It was really her cat, but she lived with me because my brother's wife is allergic. It was hard on all of us, though. Fudge really was a good cat."
"I'm sorry," I murmur, duly noting both his kindness to animals and his closeness to family. "Still, you really should have vetoed the name Fudge." He stares at me a beat and then says,
"Oh yeah? Well, you should have vetoed Brio, so there."
I burst out laughing. "And why's that?"
"Because it's Brio," Pete says with a trace of Gabe-like food snobbishness. "Most girls in your zip code cancel altogether when I pick a chain."
"You wanted me to cancel?" I say, noticing the bartender hovering near us. We don't give him an opening, and he moves on to another couple.
"I like to weed out the snobs," he says. "I'm from Wisconsin. Snobs and I don't mix."
"There are no snobs in Wisconsin?"
"Maybe two or three."
"Well, I'm not one," I say with conviction. "But my best friend is, and he accordingly advised that I cancel on you based on your restaurant choice."
"Gay foodie?"
Pete says. "Don't stereotype," I say, smiling.
"Okay, but am I right?"
I shake my head. "No, actually. He's a straight foodie." Pete raises one eyebrow and gives me a circumspect look.
"Straight male best friend?"
"And housemate," I say.
Interesting.
"You're threatened already," I say, feeling bolder by the second. Red flag.
"Trying to make me jealous already?" he retorts. Red flag.
A coy staring contest ensues until the bartender reappears. This time, we look up in order. I go with a vodka martini, straight up, Tito's if they have it, Belvedere if they don't. The bartender nods, his gaze shifting to Pete.
"And for you, sir?"
"I'll have a Miller Lite, and we'll order a flatbread, too,"
Pete says, scanning the menu. He asks if I have a preference, and I tell him to pick something with meat.
"Sausage?"
Pete asks. I nod, and as the bartender steps away to put in our order, Pete says,
Good, you're not a vegetarian. Or gluten-free, I say, thinking of my sister's latest obsession. I'm not even sure what gluten is, actually. Is it wheat or something else? No idea, he says. But you know how you can tell that someone's gluten-free? I shake my head and say no. Because they'll fucking tell you, he says, with a very cute smile. I laugh as he looks pleased with his joke. So, you're a teacher? He asks. Yes, I say, first grade. I love it. I love the kids. He nods, his eyes slightly glazed. I try to think of something more interesting to say, and then remember that I'm not trying to be interesting, or at least not more interesting than I really am. Instead, I ask a question that I'd never dream of under normal first date trying to make a good impression circumstances. How do you feel about kids? He hesitates, knowing a desperate late 30-something question when he hears one, but keeps a poker face and says, kids are great. So we have a lot in common, I say as our drinks arrive. We both like meat, gluten, and kids. Pete laughs, a genuine laugh, and raises his glass. To meat, gluten, and kids. Our glasses touch, then our knees, before we both take a sip. I swallow, wait a beat, then really go out on a limb. So, I say, this is my final date. He looks at me, appearing both amused and confused, and says, are you saying you won't go out with me again? Pretty much. No offense. I decided this before I even got here. And why'd you decide that? Pete asks. I clear my throat, then say, well, as you know from my match profile, I'm 37, almost 38. So I think it's time to throw in the towel on the whole dating and trying to find a husband routine. On top of that, I say now on a roll, my ex-boyfriend's 6-year-old daughter is in my class, a painful daily reminder that I am way behind and seriously running out of time. So unless you end up being the one and then the father of my children, this is my final date before I go secure the sperm of a stranger. Or, alternatively, move to Africa and devote my life to the poor. I smile. No pressure or anything. 2.5 hours later, our date is over, and we are both standing by the valet waiting for our cars. Although the evening was more fun than I expected, a solid 7, neither of us mentions Barnes & Noble. So? Pete says. Was this your last date after all? I smile, then say, yeah. I think so. So I shouldn't call you? Did you want to call me? Only if you want me to. I carefully consider his question, then tell the truth. I don't know. Maybe. He laughs. Can you give me a little more guidance? Well, I say, I enjoyed the evening, and I like you, but I don't think we have that spark. Pete nods and says, so does this mean you're headed to Africa? Or a sperm bank, I say, as I catch the valet giving me a double take before getting out of my car, the engine running. Well, good luck with that, Pete says. Thanks, I say, handing the valet 4 singles, then getting in my car. I can feel Pete looking at me, so I open my window and say, by the way, the cleft in your chin is cute. Pete smiles. Is it enough to get me a second date, even without a spark? You can try, I say, hedging my bets, though I'm really not going to hold my breath. I wave goodbye, then drive back down Peachtree, not even waiting to get home before giving Gabe the update. He answers on the first ring. How did it go? The seed of solo motherhood has officially been planted, I say, pun intended.
Chapter 6. Meredith. After Daniel's funeral, I was secretly relieved to go back to college and escape the unbearable suffering in Atlanta. I called my parents as often as I could make myself, as I knew how much they worried about me, more vulnerable to parental fears than ever. Yet I also tried to push Daniel from my mind, throwing myself into my classes and auditions, anything to stay busy and distracted. Fortunately, my crush on Nolan quickly faded, replaced by a bigger crush on a guy named Louis Fisher. Lewis and I met in our stage diction class that semester, and were then cast as Mitch and Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire. A brilliant actor from Brooklyn, he captivated me with his talent, though I also loved his quirkiness and urban sophistication. One night after rehearsal, we lingered backstage long after the rest of the cast and crew had departed, discovering that we had something much bigger in common than acting. We had both lost siblings. I told him about Daniel's accident, and he shared that his only sister, Ruthie, had jumped onto the subway tracks in the path of an oncoming N train, a week shy of her 16th birthday. We stayed up half the night talking, analyzing the two tragedies with a brutal frankness. We concluded that although Ruthie's death was more emotionally complicated and troubling, in some ways it felt more unfair to lose Daniel, someone who had been so happy and productive. Lewis had a larger burden of guilt for not saving his sister, whereas my guilt came in the form of being the one who had lived. It was not only cathartic to talk about our losses, but also deeply intimate. Our bond felt intense, and our chemistry unmistakable. After crying together, we hugged, then kissed. By opening night, we were a couple. Even the theater critic at the Daily Orange, known for being stingy with his compliments, praised our palpable heat as one of the best parts of the production, lamenting that Stella and Stanley didn't share a similar fire. To celebrate the review, we made love. It was my first time, and he said he wished it had been his, too. Lewis and I became inseparable. We eschewed parties and bar scenes, spending most of our time alone or with a small group of fellow actor friends. We took the same classes, auditioned for the same plays, and spent every night in his bed or mine. We were too young to think about marriage, neither of us particularly aspiring to a traditional life anyway, but we talked about the future, what would happen after graduation, whether we would work in television or theater or film, whether we should move to New York City or Los Angeles. Maybe one of us would make it big and become a splashy commercial success, but that wasn't really our goal. The only thing that mattered was that we were doing what we loved and that we were together. I was almost happy, as close as I could come given what I'd lost, and for months, everything seemed easy, the effect of true love. Until everything felt complicated, the effect of falling out of love. The unraveling began in the fall of our senior year, when we both auditioned for As You Like It. Lewis landed the part of Jacquees. A gorgeous blonde named Poppy scored the lead of Rosalind. And I got the insulting role of Audrey, a country bumpkinette goat herder. Lewis and I had never had a competitive dynamic in our relationship. But I found myself feeling insecure, resentful, and jealous, especially of Poppy, whom he seemed to worship. I developed a mild eating disorder and began to self-loathe and second-guess. I questioned my future as an actor. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't talented enough. I clearly didn't have a thick enough skin. When I confided my reservations to my parents, they both seemed relieved. They said acting had been a good experience, but encouraged me to find a more practical profession. My mom said I could always do community theater on the side, and my dad mentioned law school. A trial attorney himself, he pointed out that lawyering was just a different kind of performing. I didn't buy it. But I enrolled in an LSAT prep class and began to research law schools, telling myself it was good to have a backup plan. Always a bit sanctimonious, Lewis was appalled, accusing me of selling out. I retorted that was easy for him to say. His parents were bohemian Brooklynites. In other words, he could follow his heart without killing his parents' dreams. Things became more and more strained between us, and our sex, once passionate, turned mechanical. That Christmas break, just after the one-year anniversary of Daniel's death, my parents sat Josie and me down in our kitchen and announced that they were splitting up, their euphemism for divorce. I knew things had been rocky and that my dad was drinking again, but I still felt blindsided, devastated by this second huge blow to our family.
Without my big brother and the mooring of my parents' marriage, it was as if I no longer had a family at all. I had even less than that, in fact, because as soon as I